Episode 104. Wild birds yell out, "Wake up, dig this!" trying to startle me in my chocolate milk coffee at Spring's Rainbow. Forsythia and daffodils nodding in agreement, perfect beauty for a minute. Greetings and welcome into the Patuxent General. I am your host, Jess. This week, our focus is on an extended reading of Under the Pyramids by H.P. Lovecraft for Harry Houdini, plus a drink and a recipe that could be from the 1920s to go with it. The French 75 came out in 1926, and braised lamb with beans was on the menu at the Narragansett Hotel in Providence when Houdini stayed there in 1925. But this is my own spin on that recipe, just to make it a slam dunk in your home. But first, I must thank our Patreon subscribers. For as low as $3, you too could receive ad-free content, early access to episodes, and episodal extras. Also, check out our one-of-a-kind free gifts for the private level. These folks are the singing birds, winds in the tree limbs, distant planes, trains, automobiles, boats, and melodic children laughing that make up the ambient Patuxent sounds that are the Patuxent General, without whom we are silent. So thank you. And let's jump into this week's drink. To quote Lee Marvin's character in The Professionals, make it look like it's been hit by a French 75. Blow it to hell and gone. Let's talk about the Soissons Cannes. The French 75 cocktail celebrates the firepower of the World War I French 75mm field gun. In recent decades, this has become a potent gin-based champagne cocktail with lemon juice and sugar, served in a flute. But originally, it consisted of gin, apple brandy, grenadine, and lemon juice, served in a cocktail glass. It is one of the world's best-known cocktails, but has been shrouded in misinformation. This notable cocktail is named after the French 75mm light field gun, which, due to its portability and rate of fire, was the mainstay of the French Army during the First World War, 1914 to 1918. Capable of firing 15 rounds per minute, the French 75 was a formidable all-rounder of a gun, anti-aircraft through to anti-tank. A staggering 21,000 guns and 200 million shells were made and used during the war. Cocktails are often named after people and events in the news, and in the early 20th century, the Canon de 75 model 1897, better known as the Soissons Cannes, was a gun much in the news as a symbol of hope in the battle against Germany. William Philip Sims, an American reporter based in Paris, in March 1915 wrote, "Should France issue victorious from the present war, her success will have been due more than any one thing to her Soissons Cannes, her famous rapid-fire explosive shell 75mm cannon." It is hardly surprising that a French bartender, probably Henri Tepe, of Henri's Bar, Paris, named a cocktail Soissons Cannes, or 75, after the gun in 1914, or 15, or even earlier. Phrases likening the lethal potency of the drink to the gun, such as, "both knock you flat," abound. For this cocktail, you will need 1 1/3 fluid ounces of Calvados, 2/3 of a fluid ounce of dry gin, 1/6 of a fluid ounce of pomegranate syrup, and the juice of 1/2 a lemon. Shake all the ingredients with ice and fine strain into a chilled glass and enjoy. For braised lamb with beans, you will need, for the beans, 1 pound dried lima beans or any small white bean, 7 cups of water, 1 teaspoon dried thyme or 4 sprigs fresh thyme, 1 bay leaf, one medium-sized onion struck with two cloves, two large carrots, trimmed and scraped, and salt to taste. To prepare the beans, soak them overnight in cold water. Then, drain the beans, transfer to a saucepan, and add 7 cups of fresh water, the thyme, bay leaf, onion with cloves, carrot, and salt to taste. Bring them to a boil and simmer for 45 minutes or more until the beans are tender, skimming the surface as they cook. For the lamb portion, you will need 3 pounds lean shoulder of lamb, salt and ground pepper to taste, fresh rosemary, 1 cup chopped onion, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, and 1 cup dry white wine, 1 cup of chicken stock, 1 28-ounce can crushed tomatoes, 1 teaspoon dried thyme or 4 sprigs of fresh thyme, and 1 bay leaf. To prepare the lamb, sprinkle the meat with salt and pepper and transfer it to a heavy roasting pan. Then add the chopped onion and garlic. Add the wine, rosemary, water, tomatoes, thyme, and bay leaf, salt and pepper to taste. Roast uncovered for 45 minutes at 410 degrees Fahrenheit. Then cover with parchment and foil and roast for 12 hours at 215 degrees Fahrenheit. When the lamb is cooked, drain the beans, reserving 1 cup of the liquid. Remove the bay leaf, the onion, the cloves, and the carrots, and take the cloves out of the onion. Cut the onions and carrots into 1/2-inch cubes and then add back to your lamb. Finish with fresh mint on top, and if the final dish seems too thick, add some of the bean liquid. And enjoy.
I want to tell you about my friend Mike and his Electromagnetic Pinball Museum and Restoration Arcade. It's an all-inclusive place to relax and share anything related to modern pinball, EM pinball, and arcade games. A group of pinball and arcade fans with an addiction to games of all kinds and Lego too. $10 gets you free play on pinball and arcade games all day. You can find them at 881 Main Street, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or online at www.electromagneticpinballmuseum.com.
And now the continued reading of Under the Pyramids by H.P. Lovecraft for Harry Houdini, Chapter 2. It was very gradually that I regained my senses after that eldritch flight through the Stygian space. The process was infinitely painful and colored by fantastic dreams in which my bound and gagged condition found singular embodiment. The precise nature of these dreams was very clear while I was experiencing them, but became blurred when my recollection, almost immediately afterward, and was soon reduced to the merest outline by the terrible events, real or imaginary, which followed. I dreamed that I was in the grasp of a great and horrible paw, a yellow, hairy, five-clawed paw, which had reached out of the earth to crush and engulf me. And when I stopped to reflect what the paw was, it seemed to me that it was Egypt. In the dream, I looked back at the events of the preceding weeks and saw myself lured and enmeshed little by little, subtly and insidiously, by some hellish ghoul spirit of the Elder Nile sorcery, some spirit that was in Egypt before ever man was, and that will be when man is no more. I saw the horror and unwholesomeness, antiquity of Egypt, and the grisly alliance it has always had with the tombs and temples of the dead. I saw phantom possessions of priests with the heads of bulls, falcons, cats, and ibises. Phantom processions marching intermittently through subterraneous labyrinths and avenues of titanic propylaea beside which a man is as a fly and offering unnameable sacrifices to indescribable gods. Stone colossi marched an endless night and drove herds of grinning androsphinxes down to the shores of ill-medible, stagnant rivers of pitch. And behind it all, I saw the ineffable malignity of primordial necromancy, black and amorphous, and fumbling greedily after me in darkness to choke out the spirit that had dared to mock it by emulation. In my sleeping brain there took shape a melodrama of sinister hatred and pursuit, and I saw the black soul of Egypt singling me out and calling me in inaudible whispers, calling and luring me, leading me on with the glitter and glamour of the Saracenic surface, but ever pulling me down to the age-mad catacombs and the horrors of its dead and abysmal pharaonic heart. Then the dream faces took on human resemblances, and I saw my guide Abdul Reis in the robes of a king, with the sneer of the Sphinx on his features, and I knew that those features were the features of Khafre the Great, who raised the second pyramid, carved over the Sphinx's face in the likeness of his own, and built that titanic gateway temple whose myriad corridors the archaeologists think they have dug out of the sceptical sand and uninformative rock. And I looked at the long, lean, rigid hand of Khafre, the long, lean, rigid hand as I had seen it in the diorite statue in the Cairo Museum, the statue they had found in the terrible gateway temple, and wondered that I had not shrieked when I saw it on Abdul Reis. That hand! It was hideously cold, and it was crushing me. It was the cold and cramping of the sarcophagus, the chill and constriction of the unrememberable Egypt. It was nighted necropolitan Egypt itself, that yellow paw.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
And they whisper such things of Khafre. But at this juncture I began to awake, or at least to assume a condition less completely that of sleep as the one preceding. I recalled the fight atop the pyramid, the treacherous men in their attack, my frightful descent by rope through endless rock depths, and my mad swinging and plunging on a chill void redolent of aromatic putrescence. I perceived now that I lay on a damp rock floor, and that my bonds were still biting into me with unloosened force. It was very cold, and I seemed to detect a faint current of noisome air sweeping across me. The cuts and bruises I had received from the jagged sides of the rock shaft were paining me woefully, their soreness enhanced by a stinging or burning acuteness by some pungent quality in the faint draft. And the mere act of rolling over was enough to set my whole frame throbbing with untold agony. As I turned, I felt a tug from above and concluded that the rope whereby I was lowered still reached to the surface. Whether or not the men still held it, I had no idea, nor had I any idea how far within the earth I was. I knew that the darkness around me was wholly or nearly total, since no ray of moonlight penetrated my blindfold, but I did not trust my senses enough to accept as evidence of extreme depth the sensation of vast duration which had characterized my descent. Knowing at least that I was in a space of considerable extent, reached from the surface directly above by an opening in the rock, I dutifully conjectured that my prison was perhaps the buried gateway chapel to the old Khafre, the temple of the Sphinx, perhaps some inner corridor which the guides had not shown me during my morning visit, and from which I might easily escape if I could find my way to the barred entrance. It would be a labyrinthine wandering, but no worse than others out of which I had in the past found my way.
The first step was to get free of my bonds, gag, and blindfold, and this I knew would be no great task, since subtler experts than these men had tried every known species of fetter upon me during my long and varied career as an exponent of escape, yet had never succeeded in defeating my methods. It then occurred to me that the men might be ready to meet and attack me at the entrance upon any evidence of my probable escape from the binding cords, as which would be furnished by any decided agitation of the rope which they probably held. This, of course, was taking for granted that my place of confinement was indeed Khephren's Temple of the Sphinx. The direct opening of the roof, wherever it may lurk, could not be beyond easy reach of the ordinary modern entrance near the Sphinx, if in truth it had been any great distance at all on the surface, since the total area known to the visitors was not at all enormous. I had not noticed any such opening during my daytime pilgrimage, but knew that these things are easily overlooked amidst the drifting sands. Thinking these matters over as I lay bent and bound on the rock floor, I nearly forgot the horrors of the abysmal descent and cavernous swinging which had so lately reduced me to a coma. My present thought was only to outwit the men, and I accordingly determined to work myself free as quickly as possible, avoiding any tug on the descending line which may betray an effective or even problematical attempt at freedom. This, however, was more easily determined than effected. A few preliminary trials made it clear that little could be accomplished without considerable motion, and it did not surprise me, after one especially energetic struggle, that I began to feel the coils of falling rope as they piled up about me and upon me. Obviously, I thought the men had felt my movements and released their end of the rope, hastening no doubt to the temple's true entrance to lie murderously in wait for me. The prospect was not pleasing. But I had faced worse in my time without flinching, and would not flinch now. At present, I must first of all free myself of bonds, then trust to ingenuity to escape from the temple unharmed. It is curious how implicitly I came to believe myself in the old temple of Khephren beside the Sphinx, only a short distance below the ground. That belief was shattered, and every pristine apprehension of preternatural depth and demonic mystery revived by a circumstance which grew in horror and significance even as I formulated my philosophical plan. I have said that the falling rope was piling up, about, and upon me. Now I saw that it was continuing to pile, as no rope of normal length could possibly do. It gained in momentum and became an avalanche of hemp, accumulating mountainously on the floor and half burying me beneath its swiftly multiplying coils. Soon I was completely engulfed and gasping for breath as the increasing convulsions submerged me and stifled me. My senses tottered again, and I vainly tried to fight off a menace desperate and illocutable. It was not merely that I was tortured beyond human endurance, not merely that life and breath seemed to be crushed slowly out of me. It was the knowledge of what these unnatural lengths of rope implied, and the consciousness of what unknown and incalculable gulfs of inner earth must at this moment be surrounding me. My endless descent and swinging flight through goblin space then must have been real, and even now, I must be lying helpless in some nameless cavern world toward the core of the planet. Such a sudden confirmation of ultimate horror was insupportable, and a second time, I lapsed into merciful oblivion. And when I say oblivion, I do not imply that I was free of dreams. On the contrary, my absence from the conscious world was marked by visions of the most unutterable hideousness. God, if only I had not read so much Egyptology before coming to this land, which is the fountain of all darkness and terror. The second spell of fainting filled my sleeping mind anew with shivering realizations of the country and its archaic secrets. And through some damnable chance, my dreams turned into the ancient notions of the dead and their sojournings in soul and body beyond those mysterious tombs, which were more houses than graves. I recalled, in dream shapes, which it is well that I do not remember, the particular and elaborate construction of Egyptian sepulchres, and the exceedingly singular and terrific doctrines which determined this construction. All these people thought of was death and the dead. They conceived of a literal resurrection of the body, which made them mummify it with desperate care and preserve all the vital organs in canopic jars near the corpse. Whilst besides the body, they believed in two other elements, the soul, which after its weighing and approval by Osiris dwelt in the land of the blessed, and the obscure and portentous ka, or life principle, which wandered about the upper and lower worlds in a horrible way, demanding occasional access to the preserved body, consuming the food offerings brought by priests and pious relatives to the mortuary chapel, and sometimes, as men whispered, taking its body or the wooden double always buried beside it and stalking noxiously abroad on errands particularly repellent. For thousands of years, those bodies rested gorgeously encased and staring glassily upward when not visited by the ka, awaiting the day when Osiris would restore the ka and soul and lead forth the stiff legions of the dead from the sunken houses of the sleep. It was to have been a glorious rebirth, but not all souls were approved, nor all tombs inviolate, so that certain grotesque mistakes and fiendish abnormalities were to be looked for. Even today, locals murmur of unsanctified convocations and unwholesome worship in forgotten nether abysses, which only winged inevitable kas and soulless mummies may visit and return unscathed. Perhaps the most leeringly blood-congealing legends are those which relate to certain perverse products of decadent priestcraft, composite mummies made by the artificial union of human trunks and limbs with the heads of animals in imitation of the elder gods. At all stages of history, the sacred animals were mummified, so that the consecrated bulls, cats, ibises, crocodiles, and the like return someday to greater glory. But only in the decadence did they mix the human and animal in the same mummy. Only in the decadence, when they did not understand the rights and prerogatives of the ka and the soul. What happened to those composite mummies is not told of, at least publicly, and it is certain that no Egyptologist ever found one. The whispers of the locals are very wild and cannot be relied upon. They even hint that old Khafre, he of the Sphinx, the Second Pyramid, and the Yawning Gateway Temple, lives far underground, wedded to the ghoul queen Nitocris, and ruling over the mummies that are neither of man nor of beast. Thank you once again for joining us today at the Patuxent General. If you would like to reach out with a recipe, question, order, or a local ghost story, our email is jess@patuxentgeneral.com. Please reach out. We can't wait to hear from you, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. But until then, I'll meet you right back here next time at the Patuxent General. A Something for Posterity production, pre-recorded in Patuxent.